Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. By shrinking the state, are the Tories turning the pyramid upside down? Won't communities then simply have to organise from the bottom up? And if we do, do we have the community memory to relearn the rules? Or will we just be ordered around, as in Victorian times, by those with the money? So we get into the real politics tonight. That's community activism, how Bristol's linking up with activists 100 miles east in Bedfordshire to do some bottom-up development, turning that pyramid upside down. Also, Glenn Jenkins will be staying with us as we try and winkle out some of the motives behind Monday's Sydney siege and Tuesday's school massacre in Peshawar, and look at the implications of the EU rapprochement towards Palestine and the US government swivelling its guns away from Cuba towards the Russians. Plus, latest in our investigations into the disappearance at the end of the war of Hitler's money man, Martin Bormann. This week, we hear the Russian point of view. We start this week, Martin, with Monday's horrific siege in Sydney, certainly just right opposite a TV station. What have you gleaned about the siege, and what do you think the real motives are behind it?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to say is that this person seems to have been a lone individual, although he was using, supposedly, an ISIS black flag, which is strange because he's Iranian and most Iranians are Shia Muslims. Nevertheless, he seems to be very similar in character to the two people who were shot dead in Canada carrying out a rampage some weeks ago.
What's the similarity between the two?
Well, because in the past, these kind of individuals, we had our own bomber here in Bristol, did we not, who was went to Clifton College, relatively wealthy boy, got into was a bit of a troublesome
teenager.
Yeah,
but he was a convert to Islam.
He was a convert first of all to skateboarding, crack, hip hop, and then finally to Islam. So in other words, we're not talking about people who are embedded in the Muslim community here. We're talking about people who've got mental health issues of one kind and another. Now, the point about these individuals, and the same is true in the... So I made this point on Russia Today earlier in the week. These individuals are often easy targets to be persuaded to do crazy things. But they're not necessarily being persuaded by people in caves in Afghanistan. Virtually everybody convicted of terrorism offences in the United States has been convicted on the basis of entrapments. So in other words, people already in trouble with the law, many petty criminals, are encouraged in fact to develop an Islamic identity and are then encouraged to do crazy things or plan to do crazy things so they can be arrested and say, oh, just look at these terrible people.
Now, I can remember the shoe bomber actually was part of Al-Majarun, wasn't he?
He wasn't part of Al-Majarun because Al-Majarun's a British-based organisation, but he was taken onto the plane at Schiphol. According to Kurt Haskell, who's a senior lawyer.
Hang on, you're thinking about the underpants bomber here,
aren't
you?
The shoe bomber. The shoe bomber also got on at Schiphol.
Well, the point I'm trying to make here is that the shoe bomber was somebody who's actually had learning difficulties, and these sorts of the sort of people that are actually quite easy to manipulate, aren't they?
Well, indeed, if you think about what happened with the Guildford Four when they were arrested, they were pretty sort of out of it, hippie type people from Belfast. They're not the kind of people who are actually in the IRA at all. The kind of people who are real terrorists are quite cold-blooded, rather usually better educated than the average population, they're not these kind of
Australian
losers.
Authorities have made it very clear that he was well known to them. Actually, judging by some of the letters he'd sent to officials in Australia, other of his acts, he would have been very high up their terror watch list, somebody really probably very close to the top of it. Also, he was implicated in the death of his wife, plus a string of sexual assaults. One does wonder how this guy was able to get hold of a gun, for example.
Well, indeed, that's where the Prime Minister of Australia has asked that very question. Now, I would suggest, right, it's Christmas, so we're not going to beat about the bush. There is overwhelming evidence that virtually all of these Islamist terrorist attacks carried out in the West have been carried out by either people who've been set up or these people who have got existing personal issues which make them vulnerable to manipulation, including our own case in Bristol. Now, the question is, who is doing the manipulating? And all the evidence suggests in the United States that virtually everybody convicted of terrorism would not have been a terrorist or even considered being a terrorist if they hadn't been approached by agents of the state and encouraged to adopt certain kind of attitudes. And this goes back a long way. We've mentioned Gladio many, many times on this programme. People need to look up Gladio if they've never looked it up. But the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, for example, which killed 6 people. The explosives for that bombing were provided to the bombers by the FBI. That came out in court. So the FBI, and the guy they provided the explosives to, was their undercover agent in the cell concern, said, well, presumably you don't want this to go off. You want me to fix it so it doesn't go off. They said, no, we do want it to go off. And it did go off, and 6 people were killed, and then, of course, they were all immediately arrested because the FBI had actually engineered the whole plot. Now, this is what people have got to understand. A lot of these plots are being engineered from inside the intelligence structure. And when you see crazy
people... This is the same intelligence structure that's been torturing people, isn't
it? Indeed, indeed. The very same one. Now, I'm willing to accept the possibility that there are crazy people out there who decide to do these crazy things on their own initiative. Where they get their rifle from is another question. Probably easier in the US than in Australia. But in any case, the suspicion has always got to be, given the past history, that these kind of attacks... It's very handy, both in Canada and Australia, for these attacks to have taken place just now. Because Canada and Australia have agreed to sign up to fight the evil of Islamic State militants in
Iraq. Are you
Iraq
saying they're not evil?
Well, I'm just using it ironically. I'm saying, yes, they are evil. And but of course, they have been armed and trained by our own special forces, as we well know. I think there's evidence overwhelmingly the case that in Jordan and Turkey, British special forces have been training these people within the last 2 years. And if we're serious about smashing ISIS, perhaps we need to arrest some people in our own special forces and do a bit of waterboarding.
Well, the Daily Telegraph over in Australia has come up with a fascinating... It's called the Haron Monis, the 10 fatal failures that led to a horrific day. Failed. They granted him bail over a murder charge. They saved him from extradition. They stopped him being extradited. It was in 2000, the Iranians wanted to get him over there to put him on trial. He was dropped off the watch list, which seems incredible since he'd been sending threatening letters to government officials and people in television over there. He was granted citizenship, despite there was a warrant out in Iran for his arrest. He was allowed into the country when he was on the watch list and he should have been banned. He was given legal aid. There was a gun license mix-up, apparently. National databases, which interstate police use to share information, indicated he held a gun license. Unbelievable, isn't it, really? Failed. He was also allowed to live on welfare and given multiple identities. Well, even though they knew he had multiple identities, the authorities failed to do anything about it. And information was not shared between other agencies. So, I mean, you can imagine one or two failings, but 10.
Yeah, I think the pattern here is clear. These kind of individuals who carry out these kind of... And, of course, they're now conveniently dead, as the two guys in Canada are conveniently dead, and we'll never find out...
Dead men tell no tales.
Dead men tell no tales. But let me just come back to the political importance of this. Canada and Australia have got fairly right-wing governments at the moment, and they have enthusiastically joined in the latest in, you know, Iraq War 3. Now, in actual fact, the public in both countries are pretty dubious about why we would want to get involved in this. If you think about Australia, you couldn't get much further away from the Middle East than Australia. Do they really want to get themselves bothered in that, involved in the, in a, an internecine struggle in the Fertile Crescent? And the answer is probably not. But of course, if we're going to be attacked in our own coffee shops in Sydney, then it all becomes absolutely clear we've just got to do something. And the same thing happened that in Canada, they passed the legislation to get involved in the war in Iraq the day after the attack upon the Canadian Parliament building, which in which the guy was shot dead by the sergeant at arms who just happened to have a pistol, meanwhile having walked past all the SWAT teams on the way in there who didn't seem to be able to take him out.
Well, what you seem to be saying is that in the West we've got a criminal elite that has linked to the intelligence services, are completely invulnerable behind the shield of national security, and that they're actually involved in murdering civilians on the streets.
Yes, absolutely. The World Trade Center bombing in 1993 killed 6 civilians. The explosives for that bombing were provided to the group that carried out the attack by the FBI. There's no dispute about that.
I mean,
also,
you're talking
everybody
about
involved in it had been allowed in, even though they were already on watch lists.
What you're talking about here is a monstrous cover-up or conspiracy, supposedly. I mean, what evidence do you have for that? Surely one of these people involved in these murders would have been arrested.
Well, to be honest with you, there's actually a mountain of evidence that this is what the intelligence services do. I've mentioned Gladios. People should just do a simple search on their computer and it will come up. Fernando Imposimato is the most senior judge in Italy. He's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. He's written a book which came out at the end of December 2012, which is called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And it's about all the terrorism in Italy, left and right wing, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, including the Piazza Fontana bombing, the bombing of Bologna Railway Station, this kidnap of Aldo Moro. He was the investigating magistrate on most of these cases. And his investigations, carried out by the Italian police, point the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services. And we know for a fact that British intelligence services and special forces have been training militants to go into Syria. The former French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas has been on French television, and he made it clear that before the Arab Spring, he was approached at an international meeting by British officials. He stressed it was British officials, not US officials, said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" In other words, our special forces have no doubt been involved in training these people in Jordan and in Turkey. Now, if we're serious about stopping ISIS, then we've got to arrest our special forces, interrogate them in a humane way, find out where they got their orders from, because it's quite possible that David Cameron signed off this armed uprising in Syria. That is, I would say that they should go to The Hague for that, if that's the case.
Moving on to Tuesday, and then we had this horrific attack on an army school in Peshawar in Pakistan by the Taliban, and 132 children were shot dead, nearly 150 people all in all. Just give us a background to this conflict. Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the army, Pakistani army, who are fighting the Taliban.
Well, it's a very complicated situation because you've got various.
Are the Taliban militants based in Afghanistan or in Pakistan?
There's different. We call them Taliban, but there's a variety of different groups. And in actual fact, many people in the Pakistani military believe that Taliban groups operating inside Pakistan are being supported by Western intelligence services. So, for example, if you remember that American chap Ray Davis, supposedly that was his pseudonym, was captured by the Pakistani police, having shot dead 2 motorcyclists who were following him. The motorcyclists were probably ISI operatives. He assassinated both of those, drove round the corner, tried to escape, ran into a police roadblock, just like those SES boys in Basra ran into a local police roadblock. They arrested him, and when they got hold of his mobile phone, and it turned out he was basically a CIA operative operating out of the embassy, on his mobile phone, he had been speaking to all the top militants in Pakistan the previous week on his mobile phone. Now, the Pakistani military are very well aware of these things. General Gul, who was the commander of the ISI during the 1980s, during the war in Afghanistan against the Russians, if you go online, you will see that he is quite clear 9/11 was an inside job carried out by the US and the Israelis. Now, the Pakistani army believe those kind of things. I know that mainstream politicians in the West think, oh, no, they're just paranoid. But the fact of the matter is, people in Pakistan know an awful lot more about how real terrorism really works than many of the idiots in the media in the West.
So is there any kind of justification whatsoever for going into a school, an army school, and massacring these children?
None at all. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, when something takes place which is unacceptable, like 9/11...
But I mean,
like
maybe these Taliban might say, well, you've been killing our children.
Yes, but at the same time, I would just suggest to you that one good rule of thumb is if something looks like an act of random brutality, an unacceptable brutality, then it is. There's no excuse in my book for that kind of way of conduct. I'm not a pacifist. I understand people have to resist sometimes. The purpose of these kind of attacks is to create further conflict. So you can understand that the research and analysis wing of the Indian Army and the Israelis, they see Pakistan as a state, as a threat. So they're constantly struggling to try and destabilise Pakistan. So they're supporting Baluchi terrorists, for example, or freedom fighters, if you like, who are fighting both the Iranians and the Pakistanis. These nothing is in quite what it seems.
Glenn?
My thought on that, Martin, is serious evil begets serious evil.
Yeah.
And what sickens me, I mean, obviously, we're all sickened by the spectacle of young children. You know, I mean, it's just evil beyond measure, isn't it, to go in and wipe out children, defenceless children, etc. But what sickens me on top of that is the way that when it's white people who are being killed, whether it be 1, 2, 3 in Sydney, London, whatever, it's like trauma. It hits us like trauma. And, you know, national trauma, people go into national trauma, a state of national trauma. And yet, there's non-white kids in all of those countries just mentioned and more being brutally massacred on a daily basis, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of these countries. And there's none of the trauma associated with it. So that kind of racist, inbuilt, imperialist mindset that allows us to commit such acts of evil on other people's children. By us, I mean British power, Western power, NATO, all of this kind of thing.
Apparently, one of the reasons that the Taliban gave for this attack on the school is that the amazing number of drone strikes. We're talking about thousands of people being killed by drone strikes.
I mean,
it's, you know, I'm not saying that that's a justification, but that's the reason that they're saying is. And in fact, in the Washington Times 3 days ago, Pakistan school massacre, we got a headline counters the assertion that the Taliban have been crippled by U.S. drone strikes. There's an announcement by the US who've been doing drone strikes against the Taliban that we have crippled the Taliban with our drone strikes. So I hadn't heard this, but it's one of the possible reasons, if you can call it a reason, the Taliban may have done this is because they're saying, well, we're not crippled.
Well, I do understand the moral minefield that we're getting into here. And don't forget, for example, in World War II, the British RAF wasn't that kind to German babies, was it? And exactly. At the end of the day, we wanted to win the war, and that's what was involved. That's how anybody can use that kind of... But I would say that's a dangerous line of argument. I mean, I'd just like to mention that woman that's just won the Nobel Peace Prize, Malala Yousafzai, I think is her name. She had been shot in the head by the Taliban for attending school. And, of course, she was lionised in the Western media as somebody as a stick to beat the Taliban of Pakistan with, aren't they terrible people, whatever. Anyway, she eventually got to meet Obama. And when she got to meet Obama, she shook his hand and said, you must stop drone strikes in my country. They are not doing any good. You're killing innocent people, and will you stop it, please? Well, and they just coughed politely and moved on.
I mean, absolutely, but and no way would I, in any sense or form or way in at all, say that that's justified what's happened. All I'm saying is that if us three left this building now, and I went and bricked the house of a local maniac, and that local maniac come in and macheted you in the pub, you would hold me in some way responsible for provoking that act in the first place. And I just think that we as a country, we as a people, have to understand that if we allow such rampant murder, such evil in our name with drones and everything else, then the chickens will come home to roost at some point. And this is part of the tragic evil the horribleness that you brutalise people, people become brutal, you know.
We had the revelations last week, didn't we, about the Senate Intelligence Committee torture report.
Exactly.
Interestingly, horrifyingly, that's now largely been surpassed, the torture programme, by the drone programme. So they're now saying, well, rather than give bounties to special forces to kidnap individuals and take them to black sites to be tortured, we just take them out from the air.
Exactly.
And also, of course, there's always a tremendous amount of collateral damage. The other thing is, of course, this is, of course, totally against international law. These people should be arrested and put on trial.
Absolutely.
To see if they've actually done anything in the first place. So I think what you're saying, Glenn, there about the, you know, the whole problem with the entire drone program, Martin, is anything can be done to actually bring these war crimes to a halt?
Well, I think
stop this kind of backlash.
You just mentioned trials there, and some people say, well, what's the point of having trials? It's, you know, they've just killed 120.
But we don't know, do we, until someone's been on trial? Yeah.
The Pakistani army have killed, they've claimed to kill 67 militants, something like that, since this attack. Now, I don't know whether that's true, who they've killed, and they've gone out and
were any children killed?
Well, who knows?
Time?
The point is, the reason we have trials is not just so that the innocent, that we can be sure they're guilty. We find out who's really behind it. Ray Davis should have been put on trial for shooting those two guys who were following him inside Pakistan. He wasn't. He was taken off to the United States and let go. If he had been put on trial, we might have found out who is really behind the Taliban in Pakistan. Because the Taliban in Pakistan are being actually armed and supported by the Indians, by the Israelis and by the Americans to destabilise the Pakistani army. The Pakistani army are also helping the Taliban in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, under the table, as a response to the fact that they feel under attack from the outside. And when Hillary Clinton went to Pakistan, she spoke at an elite girls' university, which is only for women, and there was a selected audience, so it was very much, they thought it was going to be safe as houses for her. And she went into this meeting and she started lecturing them in English about how you people have got to do more to stop terrorism, whatever. And one of the women stood up and said, "Don't you talk to us like that. We know far more about terrorism than you will ever know. You are not speaking to one of your stupid election meetings in the United States here now. We're highly educated Pakistani women and we know what terrorism is all about, and you know nothing." And in actual fact, of course, we've got a great resource in this country, in the Pakistani community, that understands an awful lot more about terrorism than the idiots who write to leaders in our newspapers.
Bullingdon Club, ex-Bullingdon Club member,
well, also,
leader writers
well,
for the
also,
Financial
can
Times.
I, can I come example. Back to Syria again? We have prima facie evidence from the former French foreign minister that the British started this recent war in Syria with an armed uprising. They provided the weaponry, they provided the direction. Now, if that turns out to be the case, then I want to know whether the Prime Minister signed that off or whether MI6 did that on their own. But somebody's head should roll, because hundreds of thousands of people are dead, millions are displaced, and it's quite likely that we started it. Because the fighting...
Well, it's not us, it's our taxpayers' money.
Right, it's our taxes. And if you it's done in our name, and therefore we are held responsible. As you were saying, we've thrown the brick through the window, and therefore we've got to expect the machete attack.
Okay, let's get back to the CIA torture report, which was out last week, and little interesting bits and pieces trickling out from that too, Martin. Probably the most devastating thing, or at least for me, was that the people who designed this program, the doctors who were the unlikely architects of the CIA's torture program, benefited to the tune of $81 million from developing this psychological torture techniques. Two doctors identified by the pseudonym Dr. Grayson Swigert and Dr. Hammond Dunbar were paid $81 million by the CIA to develop and implement a 7-year program that included what they call enhanced interrogation techniques such as waterboarding, placing detainees in stress positions and sleep deprivation. Until now, little was known about the pair, who the New York Times named as James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. According to the declassified documents, they created the program in 2002 when the CIA took custody of Abu Zubaydah, a Saudi arrested in Pakistan and suspected of being an Al-Qaeda lieutenant. He was taken to an unnamed country, reportedly Thailand, where a prison detention site Green became an experimental laboratory for Swigert and Dunbar to perfect the techniques they'd learned at the US Air Force Survival, Evasion, Resistance and Escape School, where they were based before. So $81 million they made out of this technique for basically torturing people. The point being, of course, that torture doesn't always give you any kind of useful result.
Well, no, I mean...
In fact, does it ever?
Well, who could argue? It's a debatable point. But also what gets me about all of this is that the Americans are admitting that they've carried out these admittedly horrific tortures. But of course they're not mentioning that the other thing they do is they just hand over people. And with Ben Griffin, the ex-SAS chap we've had on our show, they then hand over people to other who have got no such restrictions. Mm. So Benjamin Mohammed was handed over to the Libyans and they chopped his penis with a razor. So we're not just talking about waterboarding and sleep deprivation.
That's a second kind of outsourcing.
Yeah. So what they say to you is you can have a bit of waterboarding from us, and if you don't cooperate, we'll hand you over to the Egyptians, and they don't just do waterboarding. And of course the other thing is that the School of the Americas, which was based in Georgia in the United States, trained all the torturers in Latin America without exception in the use of electricity and so on, and 30,000 people were tortured to death in Argentina, for example, by the military dictatorship, all trained at the School of the Americas in Georgia in the United States. And the Americans just cannot get their head around how evil their society has become. Even when they criticise themselves, it's pathetically
I think you've got to be careful. It's not their society, is it? It's the Pentagon, and it's the military-industrial complex, it's the links
ordinary
between...
Americans are as much victims of this as anybody else.
It's the links between the big arms firms that are making a lot of money out of war, oil companies, etc., and the big powerful lobbies like the Council on Foreign Relations that represents the oil lobby and actually brings their policy
and
into
there's also
the Pentagon.
There's also a great deal of input from the Israeli intelligence services into all of this, and they punch way above their weight.
Okay, last weekend, Sir Malcolm Rifkin demanded details of the UK's involvement in CIA interrogation. Sir Malcolm Rifkin is the chairman of he's a former Conservative Defence Secretary, I think, and he's now the chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee. Why is he demanding details of Britain's involvement from the CIA? Because what the CIA have said is, well, your security services that he's supposed to oversee have told us not to print stuff.
Well,
doesn't he ask the people he's supposed to be overseeing for this information?
Well, I mean, Malcolm Rifkin is a kind of figure for supposed oversight of the intelligence services. I mean, it's just laughable, really. Given what we know about what the US intelligence services get up to, and that means that the British are very much in there with them because they're virtually best buddies. Given what we know, the idea that there's no torture, and if this torture, it's a few bad apples and all the rest of it, it's way beyond that. It's become an absolutely... The new military regime in Egypt has just sentenced hundreds of people to death for their political opinions. No doubt they were torturing with electricity, water, bastinado, the usual stuff, strappado, all of that stuff. But who mentions it? Do you know how many political prisoners there are in Saudi Arabia? 30,000 in a country with about population, I don't know what the population is, but it's not that great. And these people...
And we're just building a new base over in Bahrain, aren't we?
Oh, indeed we are. And, of course, in this city, in Filton, one of the most successful industrial clusters in Britain, is basically dependent on supplying weaponry to, guess where? Saudi Arabia.
Well, they also do wings for the civilian Airbuses as well.
Oh, that's all right, then.
And civilian jet engines from Rolls-Royce, etc.
The Saudis are key to all of this because they have been definitely supporting the most militant groups in Syria. They are our closest
allies. Well, isn't the Bin Laden family a Saudi family?
Well, they are.
We're going back to 9/11 here, aren't we?
Of course they are, but let's go back to the 1980s when Bin Laden was a subcontractor to MI6 and the CIA under the Operation Cyclone program. What we are expected to believe that this Jihadi International Brigade that was set up in the 1980s by the Americans with the British in the lead, which is why the French police used to refer to London as Londonistan, because all of these extremist Muslims were all based in London, because it was part of the British plan to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. We're supposed to believe that all these groups were set up, and then suddenly they just lost control of them, and off they went, and there's nothing we could do about it. Even they admit that that's what the story is.
So
Bin Laden was definitely a CIA agent.
Are the House of Saud, then, the Saudi royal family? Because it's not a democracy, is it?
No, they were...
And they've been going for quite a while,
They've been in power since the 1920s, and they were were put in power by the, guess who, MI6, in order to try and control the oil and so on. I mean, these states in the Gulf are very fragile states. They haven't got any elasticity. The Iranian state is a proper state. They have elections. You kill the president, it won't do any good because there's a vice president. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, you really have it. I've seen it referred to as a glass pillar of Western imperialism. At one moment, it will shatter. And when it shatters, it will be catastrophic.
You mean like it did in Iran, for example, exactly. In the Iranian Revolution?
Well, don't forget that the oil in Saudi Arabia is all concentrated just over the border from Bahrain. It's all just there. And all of the people in that area are actually Shia Muslims. The majority of the oil workers in Saudi Arabia are Shia. And Saudi state doesn't really exist as a state. It's not a proper state. It's just a made-up state. So if there was to be a rearrangement of the borders in the Middle East, then maybe there would be a kind of greater Bahrain, which would be democratically controlled by Shia. And they would not necessarily have the same policies as the House of Saud.
Getting back to the torture report, though, Martin, it's fascinating. It always takes a few days for the most interesting bits of analysis to be done of these kind of massive documents which are released to the public. Patrick Coburn did a marvellous job in last weekend's Independent. The CIA torture report: agency conduct was driven by pressure to link Iraq to Al-Qaeda following 9/11. And what he's doing is looking at the small print, basically saying, being told repeatedly by the CIA that there was no reliable intelligence about any links. Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld insisted harsher methods be used. The officer said there was constant pressure on the intelligence agencies and the interrogators to do whatever it took to get that information out of the detainees. And when people kept coming up empty, they were told by Cheney and Rumsfeld people to just push harder.
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is supposedly the mastermind of 9/11, he was given 120 waterboardings.
183,
before he finally decided, yes, I did it. It was me. And, of course, the fact
is... Man.
Yeah. Now, the point is that the torture is used in order to create the myths, but the myths are the real problem. The real terrorists are clearly, to my mind, inside the Western intelligence service.
Well, ISIS aren't, are they?
Yes, they are.
No, they're not. No, they're not. They're former jihadis who were mostly... It's mostly run by former jihadis who were detainees in some of these black sites, and many of them were tortured.
Well, as they say, at Guantanamo, they've got two sections. One is Strawberry Fields and one is Penny Lane. Strawberry Fields is forever. Those people are never going to be allowed out. Penny Lane means that you're going to be turned. So many people are imprisoned, like the two guys who set up the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, I think it was called, I can't remember the name of it, but they had been held in Guantanamo. They arrived in Yemen, they were released, they arrived in Yemen, and then they set up this group which then supposedly put the underpants bomber on the plane or whatever. Now, most of these transnational jihadi groups, in my view, are run by the Western intelligence services. They have been since the 1980s. You've got genuine radical movements in the Muslim world, such as Hezbollah and Hamas, who've got a genuine mass base and military wings. But they are not part of these kind of attacks. Hezbollah has, for example, probably the most successful use of suicide bombers ever was their attacks, simultaneous attacks on the US Marines in Beirut in 1983, and the Hezbollah's position is, we don't believe in suicide attacks because, you know, life is given by God and you shouldn't throw it away. But if it's the only way to get in there, then we accept having suicide attacks. So they carried out two suicide attacks with trucks full of explosives, drove them into the Marines base, and they killed 283 US Marines in uniform on that occasion. And the very next day, the Americans withdrew from Lebanon. They went back to their ships and then just shelled Lebanon from their ships at random to demonstrate their fury at what had happened. Now, that is the military use of suicide bombers. Many, as you've pointed out in the Press Gazette, Tony, many times when people claim there's a suicide bomb attack taking place, there isn't actually a suicide.
Okay, yeah, let's go back to that specific incident that I think you're referring to, which I wrote an article about, which was the beginning of the Shia insurgency in Iraq, where a newspaper was closed down. I think it was the Al-Saud, not Al-Saud, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, he was one of the resistance fighters against the American occupation, the British occupation. And the Americans came and closed down, I think it was under Bremer, claimed to close down the newspaper because the previous day they'd had a front page story which said this suicide bombing, which had been wired all around the world, that had taken place, wasn't a suicide bombing at all. They'd got a collection of 10 or 12 eyewitnesses that were saying, actually, a helicopter fired a missile at the place. Yeah. And any idea that it was a suicide bomber for anybody that was within hundreds of yards was ridiculous. And yet it's incredible how quickly the lie travels around the world before the truth has a chance to get out.
Well, that's right. I mean, the assassination of Rafik Hariri in Lebanon was blamed on Hezbollah, and they said that's Hezbollah's suicide bomber, the usual story. And then Hezbollah gave a press conference in Beirut. They said, we don't really want to do this because it's giving too much away, but have a look at this, folks. And it was a video feed from the Israeli drone, which they claimed had fired the missile which killed the president of Lebanon. Now, are they capable of killing their own side, either civilians at random or political supporters of their own, in order to try and get political effects? The answer is yes, they are, because they're on the record of doing exactly that. We know that Western intelligence services bombed Bologna railway station in 1980, killing 86 people. That's not disputable. That is a fact. Now, if an organisation like the IRA, for example, or the PLO, was carried out an attack like that, you would say it was definitely a terrorist organisation. And since nobody's been punished, no doubt they're still doing it. NATO intelligence services are on the record as killing civilians in Western Europe, never mind in Yemen and wherever else. And it's about time people woke up. The hour is very late. The situation is very grave. And the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta a couple of years ago, all the evidence suggests that was carried out by the rebels with help from NATO and the Saudis. I mean, and that means presumably somebody in our special forces knows exactly what happened there. And those who use chemical weapons, I remember Obama said at the time, it's a red line. So what should we do? When are the RAF going to bomb London?
Okay, but Martin, this puts me in mind rather of the collateral murder video, which was leaked by, it looks like now, by Chelsea Manning, mm-hmm. To WikiLeaks, which showed US helicopter forces killing a dozen or so in Basra, I think it was, or possibly in Baghdad, using a helicopter gunship and actually killing Reuters cameramen at the same time. You know, this kind of thing, it went completely, it seems, unpunished.
Yeah, but that's just random brutality.
And what happened to the whistleblower?
Well, you can see, but let's more importantly think about those two SAS lads that were arrested in Basra with what the local police said, the car had a bomb on board. Where were the SAS going in Basra with a bomb in their car?
Good question. Anyway, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions now. And Tony Baldry brought up Russia.
So Tony Baldry! Yeah. Yeah. Tony Ed smiling.
He's laughing. The rest of them look sad, aren't you?
They look totally glum.
Can I commend my right honourable friend to some advice from Karl Marx? Who, when the European correspondent of the New York Tribune observed that these vital interests should render Great Britain the earnest and unyielding opponent of the Russian projects of annexation and aggrandisement, and went on, in the arrest of the Russian scheme of annexation, the interests of democracy and of England go hand in hand. Does my right honourable friend agree for the United Kingdom, Europe, the West, and indeed the whole world, one of our most important foreign policy priorities for 2015 should be to see that Russia behaves as one would expect a member of the Security Council to behave in the interests of international...
Prime Minister!
I very much agree with my rightable friend. I haven't spent as much time studying Karl Marx as he has, or perhaps even as the Leader of the Opposition has. I don't know what goes on in Camden these days. But anyway, what I would say is, in this respect, Karl Marx was right, that the interests of the United Kingdom and democracy do go together. We should stand up very firmly against the Russian aggression that has taken place. We led the way in Europe in making sure there were sanctions, and what the combination of the lower oil price and the sanctions are showing, that I think it isn't possible for Russia to be part of the international financial system but try and opt out of the rules-based international legal system. That, I think, is what is being demonstrated, and we should keep up the pressure.
Blackwell!
Yes, this from the chap who may well have signed off on starting an uprising in Syria. Let's come back to Ukraine. At the beginning of the crisis, in the Maidan Square in Kiev, they shot the Holy Hundred. Snipers shot what they call the Holy Hundred. It was about 20 police officers, Berkut police officers, and 80 protesters were shot through the head by snipers. There's an intercepted telephone call from Umas Piats, the Estonian foreign minister, to Catherine Ashton, the British representative as the foreign representative of the EU, and it has been confirmed by Piats as a genuine phone call, in which he says, "We've just been round the hospitals, they're making it clear to us that the snipers were all from the same group, and they were all based, they were all from the current regime, not the previous regime." So in other words, the current regime in Kiev killed those people. And the far-right group Pravi Sector, which is the main, and Andrei Paribi, who is their leader, who are the main suspects in that shooting, have intimate links with NATO's Gladio networks going back to the 1940s. Okay, so let's just tick that one off. Then there was a massacre in Odessa, where people who were not very happy with the change of the undemocratic change of regime in Kiev were peacefully protesting. They were attacked by paramilitary formations, again organised by Pravi Sector and Andrei Paribi, and the official death toll is 40-50. Unofficially, it seems like several hundred people were tortured and burned in Odessa. Then, of course, the loss of MH17, the aircraft, which was supposedly shot down by the rebels.
Malaysian Airbus.
Yeah, the Malaysian. And it's only recently that the Malaysian government has been allowed into the investigation.
Boeing.
Yeah.
Boeing, not an Airbus.
Yeah. Now, all of the evidence suggests that that was actually carried out by two fighters who were shadowing the plane from Kiev. Now, if they did that, they would probably have done that in consultation with their big advisors in the United States and Germany and Britain. So, in other words, the response of the Russians to what has happened in the Ukraine is entirely defensive. There has been no attempt, for example, to annex Donetsk and Luhansk. The Russians have tried very hard to try and find some kind of stable negotiated settlement there. Unlike Kosovo, of course, in southern Yugoslavia, I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s, where it's been recognised by all Western countries, but not by Spain, of course, because there's a real implication there for the Basques and the Catalans. Now, in other words, the West is protesting way too much about what's happened in Ukraine. They imposed a new regime in Ukraine using terrorist methods. So the shootings in the Maidan, the massacre in Odessa, the killings of the international airline passengers on MH17, all of that goes back to what we were talking about before this section, which is NATO's criminal intelligence services. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Russian military know exactly what happened in all of those cases. And they are not being aggressive. They are not going to back down, though. And, of course, let's come to the sanctions. The Russian economy is now starting to hurt. We can all pat ourselves on the back for that, can't we? We're in the biggest economic crisis since World War II, and then we're running our policy to try and drive the Russians into the floor. The only problem with that is that the next domino to fall, if the Russian economy does go down the drain, is the German economy. What do you think happens in Britain if the German economy goes down the drain? Don't answer that. And, of course, in 1998, when the Russians actually ran out of money to pay their debts, that's what caused the collapse of long-term capital management in the United States, which led to massive intervention by the Clinton administration to prop up the financial system. It's absolutely idiotic, as Putin has pointed out, to try and wreck the Russian economy. You wreck the Russian economy in a globalised world, you are wrecking your own economy, and that's what will happen.
Vladimir Putin gave a three-hour press conference yesterday with all the world's press there, people from all over the world, not just from Russia, including Ukraine. And I was waiting for the question from one of the Ukrainian representatives there to see what he'd asked him, and he quite pointedly said, well, look, what are you doing about all these Russian soldiers that are over in the southeast of Ukraine, in the Donetsk region? And this was Putin's reply.
Or voluntarily take part into some military action, including the action in the east of the Ukraine, are not mercenaries, as they are not paid for those military actions. And in our public opinion, what is taking place in the east of the Ukraine is definitely a punitive operation, but it is organized by the Ukrainian authorities. and not by anybody else. These were not the militia of the Southeast who sent their military units to Kiev, but those were the Ukrainian army who moved their artillery system and their shelling system to the southeast of Ukraine. Let me explain what the problem is and how we can find a way out from the situation. The problem is that after the coup d'etat, and no matter what you say about it, it was definitely a coup d'etat that happened in Kiev. It was a forceful overthrow. Instead of starting a political dialogue, the new authorities started to use the law enforcement agencies first, and when it didn't work out, they sent the army. When it didn't work out either, they started to apply other methods, for example, the economic blockage and the economic cut and the cutting off of the economic ties with the Southeast.
Well, as you can see, what the Russians are trying to do, and Putin as their leader, his opinion poll ratings have gone up, incidentally, so all of this pressure hasn't worked if anybody thought it was going to. They are trying to de-escalate the situation. They're not pointing fingers, as I've just done, at the Western intelligence services for carrying out these three attacks. But on the other hand, they will probably know very well exactly what's happened. The problem is that Western public opinion, it's easy to make an enemy image of Russia. But the current regime in Russia is probably the most democratic, the most liberal-minded that they've ever had. When are we going to start invading Saudi Arabia?
Finally, Martin, just to wrap up for the year, what are your thoughts about some positive things that have come out of this? Because we've seen a couple of years now moves against, for example, Syria and other people in the Middle East being blocked, haven't we, in the summer? And actually, you know, Britain holding its head high in some ways in stopping US action.
I'm afraid, that was it not last year that we tried to stop the war in Syria? Not this year. This year things have got bad. I mean, the war in Ukraine has been the main issue this year, and it will continue to be the main issue because it's the fault line where World War III could start if the Russians were crazy, but they're not.
Where do the Chinese stand in all this?
The Chinese would like, basically both the Russians and the Chinese just want a quiet life. They want to get on with developing their economy and trading with the West, and they've got elements within their governments in both countries who just want to try and back down and settle things. On the other hand, they're being undermined by the fact that the West is not really open to negotiation. They want regime change in both Russia and China.
And what about,
they won't settle for anything
what
less.
About Putin's allegory yesterday about the Russian bear, and we can't sit still, otherwise we'll be chained down and they'll have our teeth out?
Well, that's right, and the Russians are acting entirely defensively, and I must say they've behaved diplomatically very, very intelligently, and from a military point of view, you look, in actual fact, the rebels in the southeast have thrashed the Ukrainian army, made up as it is, of mercenaries and thugs.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Glenn, bottom-up development. Now, what is the... First of all, over in Marsh Farm, what's this about, and what's its link to Bristol?
Bottom-up development is a programme which we have devised in Luton, and we've partnered with community organisers in several different places throughout the UK, one of which being one of our closest partnerships we have is with people in Bristol. So we've been working with community organisers in Bristol as part of the National Community Organisers Programme. Now, bottom-up development, if I could give you a quick précis on what I mean by that, one way of explaining it in fairly briefly is to say that there's an old saying, and it's a true saying, it takes a village to raise a child. And if you take the village to mean the estate I live on, what you'd find is that rather than the villagers, i.e. the local people, using the wealth of skills, nursing, you know, all of the skills that mothers have, etc., etc., family support skills, all instead of using those things in the way a village would use those skills, what actually happens is that for every problem we have in poor communities, an industry develops on the back of that problem. And people from outside of the community, professionals in big inverted commas, are abseiling in order to, with pre-packed solutions, one-size-fits-all solutions, and tend to the problem at hand, whether that be social services, whether that be regeneration and community development. There's always a band of experts on hand to come and tend to our needs. Now, what I'm saying is that if what we're saying in terms of bottom-up development's about recognising that there are skills that exist in communities, which I call it grease the natural, Tony. So in other words, let me give you an example. If there's a case of social service need, for example, someone who might, I've worked with people who are single parents and needed support with that parenting, you know, because they've been family tragedy, etc., etc. And what generally happens in the provision culture is we wait till the car's crashed, we wait till something's gone wrong, and then social services come in and try and tidy up the mess. If you were to grease the natural, what you would do is use the same public money that we use to pay for this expensive and quite ineffective in lots of cases. Not in all cases, of course. I wouldn't say that social services have no purpose or benefit. Even in a top-down provision, there are benefits to it and some great people who work in it. But the actual system which usurps or replaces the local provision of care and buys in professional external care is not only damaging, it ruins the village, the capacity of that village to raise a child. Now, take for example this, a single parent who needed babysitting basically and some home support and in order to be able to do his work. That wasn't available to him because there hadn't been a crisis or a trauma yet. So social services can't come in. Now, what we would have done and could have done and should have done is use the same public money, but much less of it, to pay some local people, experienced mums, experienced grands, etc., to provide that kind of care and support.
Now, but bidding for public money is the province of these enormous organisations like G4S and Serco nowadays. They seem to have, these big organisations, almost a lock on taking that public money. A small local organisation finds it very much more difficult to bid for that.
That is the nature of the structure. I call it mafia of the mediocre. You know, there's a mafia of mediocre provision, but which is increasingly locked into what they call prime contractors. And to be a prime contractor to deliver these fights, you need a 20 million or more turnover. So it does lock it completely down to the big providers, and they're the epitome of everything I'm just talking about.
Okay, so what's happening in Bristol, and how can we follow what's happening here? Because it sounds interesting. It sounds like exactly what the city needs, particularly with all the £90 million over 3 years of cuts that the mayor's implementing.
Well, the good news is that we're about to pilot a process in Marsh Farm, which is called the Organisation Workshop. And the Organisation Workshop is, in a nutshell, it's a large group capacity building exercise whereby people who live in the community, as I explained earlier on, we've measured our economy and we've found about 36 areas of business where we could develop local businesses to provide the same service. We're working in partnership with that within the Community Organisers Programme with organisers in Bristol. So we're due to pilot the process in March 2015 in Luton. We'll be inviting a few of the organisers from Bristol down to take part in that process. It's an 8-month process, actually, but we're inviting people to periodically take part and then to come back to Bristol with those seeds and plant them here.
Okay, what sort of organisations are you actually pre-existing groups are there in Bristol that you're dealing with then? And what parts of the city?
Well, you've got your ACORN organiser group here.
We had them on a few months ago.
Yeah, a few months ago, yeah. I mean, they're a fantastic team of people. You've got Jose and the community organiser groups who we've met through the programme. Their whole network is connected to several different groups, Stokes Croft groups, you know, throughout Bristol. And I think the idea is, I mean, our strategy in Luton is that we work in one community, one estate. And the beauty of working in one estate is that you can make change and measure change and therefore prove change. And it's hard to argue against change in another community when you've got such a profound example of betterness in an existing one. So the idea is that we work closely with Bristol, pilot this method in 2015, and then, God willing, by the end of 2015, Bristol could be second in terms of rolling out the OW.
Fantastic. Well, sounds like good news. Let's more power to your elbow, sir.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
finally this week. Well, if you've been following the show week after week, you have been hearing about our investigations into this chappy, Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's treasurer at the end of the Second World War. During the week, I came across a Russian documentary about him, and it seems that they're coming to certainly the same sort of conclusions over in Russia and have been for many years that we're coming to here, that there was some kind of collusion between the Allies, particularly the Brits and the Americans, at the end of the war with Hitler in order to basically get hold of some of the loot that he'd looted from the whole of Europe. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now.
According to some information, Bormann survived in that Berlin mincing machine.
Cross-interrogation of top officials and intelligence data said the following. Top secret to Marshal of the USSR, I.V. Stalin. I report about the message of the head of the intelligence of the First Belarusian Front about the destiny of Hitler and other state and political officials of Germany, made up after the testimony of the captive German generals. According to the prisoner's testimony, Bormann escaped in order to hand the Führer's testament to Deniz. Head of the Chief Intelligence Agency, General Kuznetsov. On May 10, Marshal Zhukov made an official statement. We don't know about the whereabouts of Führer's personal assistant, Bormann. The disappearance of Bormann worried Stalin and spoilt all his joy of the victory. At first sight, it doesn't matter if Germany is defeated and the red flag is fluttering over the Reichstag. Stalin realized that Bormann's disappearance is not occasional and will have dangerous consequences. Stalin knew about the attempts of Hitler's leaders to make a separate agreement with allies. The Führer hoped that Germany would be the arena of a new war. But now, between Russia and America, millions of German soldiers were still armed. Dozens of Wehrmacht divisions presented a force ready to carry out new orders.
Now, there's certainly going to be some more, I think, on that particular topic in the new year. And I was quite interested to see that the Russians were coming back basically from the same page as we were. Anyway, that's all time to sign off now. The Murdoch News at 7 o'clock coming up, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. We're back in 3 weeks' time on Friday the 9th of January. Until then, have a great holiday. Our sister show Dialect is on Monday at 11 a.m., where we'll be hearing about African witchcraft. And when we'll discuss...